Okay. All right. Finally done with the stressful busyness of school, so a little relaxation time. My special spot next to you, closer to you.
So if I drop something?
Yeah, basically.
Apparently, it takes Linda a while to grade 110 exams, so we'll be getting them back on Tuesday. Okay, so I don't know how anybody did, except for two that I looked at that did really well. But I don't know if there's predictors on everybody or not, but we'll find out by Tuesday. Okay? Not yours. I think for that, Chris, I'm going to pick on you again today as a guinea pig later on. Okay. All right. So we're into the final legs of the semester now, the final portion of the course. We've gone through motor systems. We've gone through sensory systems. We've gone through various homeostatic mechanisms in the nervous system. So now we're into the portion where we try to deal with higher order functions in the nervous system. Things that begin to get into the domain of things that people outside the neurosciences are particularly interested in. Things like learning and memory, cognition, problems that go wrong with the nervous system, various other aspects of it. Okay. So I'm going to mostly define terms today and look at a few specific examples, and then we'll get more into the neurobiology of some of these starting next Tuesday. Okay, everybody know who the guy is up here in the upper left hand? Anyone not know him? Not recognize his face? Obviously, he's another professor here at UT Dallas, right? Interestingly enough, when Einstein died, his brain was actually preserved. He didn't know that was going to happen, but it was actually preserved at his autopsy at Princeton. And it's actually still available for study, or at least pieces of it are still available, because it's been 50 years almost now, and an awful lot of pieces have been taken away and used for study, and they're not valuable for any particular use again. But if you write a proper grant proposal right now, you could potentially get a piece of Einstein's brain for study. Obviously, a person well known for their intellect, one possible hypothesis is that that could be because of differences in his brain. Seems like a reasonable hypothesis to test. So people have actually gone in and tried to find what the basis is that, you know, made Einstein well known for his intellect, as opposed to presumably none of you are recognizable to everyone else on the planet at this point in time for your intellectual prowess. Maybe some of you will in the future, but probably not right now. Okay. So, obviously we know from studying the nervous system that the most important cells in the nervous system are these guys, right? Neurons. That's why we call it neuroscience. Turns out we haven't been able to find any differences in the neurons in Einstein's brain from any Joe Schmo off the street that you might select for comparison. In fact, Einstein's brain is slightly smaller than normal, but not outside the normal range. So it didn't take a big brain to be able to pull off general theory of relativity or various other things that he's known for. Anyone know the major difference in his brain from ours? Glial cells. Okay, it turns out he actually has a larger than typical number of glial cells in a lot of areas in the brain, and stronger myelination of a number of different pathways as a consequence. But not just those macroglia, in fact, microglia are enhanced in lots of areas in his brain as well. So again, as I pointed out, I think the very first lecture in class this semester, you know, everything we think we know may be wrong. Maybe we should be paying a lot more attention to the glial cells in the nervous system than we are at this point in time. There's been numerous other studies of other people's brains post-mortem that suggest that there may be some correlation with the number of glial cells or the efficiency of function of glial cells and the output of the nervous system. Even though these are not cells that are in direct synaptic contact with one another, they certainly do more than just garbage collection within the nervous system. And in fact, they can participate in signaling within the nervous system. Some of them, in fact, fire action potentials, which again is total violation of the rules we think of about the nervous system. Others fire in wave-like firing patterns, not an actual action potential, but depolarization followed by hyperpolarization, driven by calcium channels within glial cells. Many of them release chemical messengers, including some of the things that we think of as classical neurotransmitters like glutamate, lysine, and various other substances. So, even though we've restricted most of our discussion to neurons and interconnections between neurons and neuronal function, hopefully sometime in the future we'll be more inclusive. Okay, so I include myself within the general nomenclature of, you know, not being complete enough in our discussions of the nervous system. But at least I want to point these things out to you periodically. At least we're aware of the fact that we're more ignorant than we should be at this point in time. Okay. Don't use that as an excuse for why you failed the last exam, though. Yes?
If glia acts so much like neurons, what makes them glia? How can we tell?
Well, they don't form synaptic contacts.
That's the only
Okay. So we can't talk about projections from one region to another carried out by glia. But we don't know what their organizing scheme is, except for the ones that wrap themselves around axons. And we thought we understood that really well, but we're actually probably now learning that we don't even understand that as well as we do. Okay, in terms of what they look like, and this is a classic pyramidal neuron. This could be a neuron, but that's glia. Could be a stellate neuron. Or a medium spiny neuron in the basal ganglia, if you can remember back to that section of the course. In terms of the morphology, just looking at the gross appearance of the neuron isn't enough. There are a few proteins that are unique to neurons that are not found within glial cells and vice versa. Since most glial cells have what we call GFP, glial fibrillary protein. Neurons don't make that, glia do. Some of their cytoskeletal proteins are different. The mechanism by which they release some of those neurotransmitters is typically different in glial cells. It involves different proteins in the release mechanism than it is in neurons. But embryonically, they're derived from the same cells. So they're a different phenotype, but not a different genotype. This is a term that we're going to struggle with for the rest of the semester. Memory. Hopefully you will have a memory, at least, of our having had this discussion. Now, we're at a disadvantage as biological scientists talking about memory, say, compared to physical scientists or computer scientists. When they talk about memory, they mean a very specific, discrete thing that they can point to and define very, very concretely. So most of you are used to thinking, for instance, about the memory maybe in your laptop or in your home computer. It's a distinct piece of hardware. We can localize it. We know where it is. In fact, it's actually a distinct portion of the buffers on this particular chip is really the memory, and the rest of it's just conductive pathways, things to regulate voltage and things of that sort. In fact, we can talk about different types of memory and hardware. Volatile memory, non-volatile memory, write-once memory, read-only memory, a whole variety of things. When we start talking about memory in biological systems, and particularly in humans, the terms are much looser. Can anyone point to the portion of their head where memories are stored? Somewhere in that head, huh? You're sure of that?
Probably,
because you probably don't have any memories if you don't have that head, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Then again, you're probably dead if you don't have that head. And we have no proof that dead people have memories. It's hard to measure that anyway. So I'll buy that argument that it's somewhere in your head. But can you point to any discrete region in the brain where your memories are? Okay, for instance, you know your birthday, right? You should? No, you don't have to tell us. Okay. Any idea where that's stored in your brain? Think it's stored a million times in your brain or a billion times in your brain?
Maybe.
Or once? We have no idea. We literally do not know an answer to a question that simple about memory and where it's located in the brain. We're not any closer to knowing that than people were 100 years ago that were trying to address those kinds of questions. Okay. Let's look at things like this that everybody thinks they know about memory. We know that information gets into our head. Okay, it could be something you read, something you heard, something you touched. Any of your senses can provide inputs into the nervous system. And we often use this term, short-term memory. Okay, and we think we can differentiate that from what we would call long-term memory. Anybody remember the first word I said in class today?
Okay.
Nobody? I remember it because I primed myself to do so. It was before. Before anybody else asks. Okay, Linda has not finished grading the exams yet. Blah, blah, blah. Okay. Nobody remembered before. Was that a long time ago? Yeah, it was less than 10 minutes ago. Was that a long-term memory deficit? Maybe. Pardon?
It might have been just a failure to encode.
Might have been a failure to encode. Okay, that's another term we'll have to deal with in a minute. Okay. Does anybody remember that I said that, you know, exams aren't graded yet? Okay. Everybody at least remembers that. Okay. Is that a short-term memory or a long-term memory?
Probably short-term.
Probably short-term, because probably by the time you walk out today, some people are going to forget. Hopefully, for some of you, it's at least entering into long-term memory. Okay. How about your name? Is that in long-term memory?
Yes.
Hopefully so. Okay. I don't think anybody's forgotten their name today. How about your address right now? Is that a long or a short-term memory?
Long-term.
for hopefully for many of you it's long term, but what if you just moved today? Could be short term. What if you were transient at this point in time? You were sleeping in your car or something. Your address might be different every single day, maybe even several times a day. The point I'm trying to make here is that many of the terms that we use in memory are what we call operationally defined terms. They're sort of defined by whatever we want them to mean. Operational means in the moment, in the specific context. In some contexts, something that happened, at the beginning of the class, now 13 minutes ago, is a very short period of time. In other contexts, that would be a very long period of time. So which do we mean when we talk about short term? In some contexts, a psychologist might tell you that short term is the length of time that you could remember 7 digits. Remember the days when phone numbers only had 7 digits? Okay, that was supposed to be our total span that we could remember. 7 digits, maybe plus or minus one. Anybody here have a 7 or 8 digit phone number? No, everybody's phone numbers these days are 10 digits long. Can you all tell people your phone number? Sometimes you have to look at your cell phone. Okay. So maybe you're one of those people that can only hold 7 digits. But most people these days can manage 10 and maybe even be able to remember somebody else's number long enough to punch it into their phone. And then they can forget it again forever. Then they have to just remember the person's name. Or if they have an iPhone, they can look at the person's face on their phone. Okay. But at least they got to know that that's the person they're trying to call. So short term might mean something that you can only hold for a very, very short period of time. Could be something like a few milliseconds. I think everybody would agree that's short. A neuron can do a lot of things in a few milliseconds time. They can find thousands of action potentials in a second's time. So it could definitely fire several action potentials in a few milliseconds time. In terms of number of ion channels opening and closing, there's a lot of events going on. Number of molecules of kinases becoming activated or inactivated, proteins phosphorylated or dephosphorylated. Awful lot can go on in that period of time. That's long enough to be synthesizing some proteins. So what do we mean specifically when we say short-term memory and long-term memory? Is there any concrete thing we can point to and say, this is a short-term memory and this is long? No, they're operationally defined. Most people would agree that you learned your name a long time ago and that's stored in long-term memory. I'll show you some evidence on Tuesday that long-term memories are only stored when we're able to synthesize new proteins. So long-term memory requires protein synthesis. So the best of the operational definitions we have right now is that short-term memory is something that does not require protein synthesis. But what we mean by short could be something from a few milliseconds, maybe to even a day. We could block protein synthesis in your brain and you could just keep chanting the same word over and over again. It would be nonsense by the end, but you'd still have it in short-term stores. And in fact, there may be even variations in what we mean by short. There's a word that we often use we call consolidation. To in some way infer that there's a process that moves information from short-term stores to long-term stores in the brain. How does the brain consolidate memories? What's the process? Obviously, if we have a word for it, we must know how it's done. No. Unfortunately, having a word makes it sound concrete. We have some ideas of some of the processes involved in consolidation. but we certainly don't know all of them. We don't even necessarily know all of the cells that are involved in the process. We definitely don't know where they're stored in long-term memory for most things. And we can't point to one neuron and say, this is where your birthday lives. Presumably it's in more than one neuron, but we can't even point to how many there are to point to. Then we have the additional problem. When we say that we have something in memory, that we remember it, we only know that we remember it if we can get it back out. If there's actually some way of outputting it, whether it's as a thought in our head or it's an actual behavior that we emit. Okay? Take as an example what you did on Tuesday. You sat down with an exam in front of you. Since it was a multiple guess exam, it was really more of a case of recognition memory than anything else. Did you recognize answers, and were they consistent with the logic of the question? Except for those annoying things that were bonus questions where you actually had to generate something completely from within your head and actually write a word down. Okay. In most cases, you all probably had a memory about every single thing on the exam if you were in class that day, or if you listen to somebody else's recorder, or if you read the book. How many of you predict that you got 100% on that exam? Nobody's predicting that? Chris is predicting that. We'll see if that's true.
With bonus questions?
No, I mean 100% of everything that was available. Don't think so? Well, in that case, was that a failure? In forming the short-term memory? Was it a failure in consolidating the memory into a long-term store? Or was it a failure in being able to find the information? Or in being able to access it and read it back out? Or was it just that this whole process takes so long you only got halfway through the exam? So your excuse is that my brain's just really slow today. We don't know answers to those questions either. In fact, we don't even know what any of the mechanisms are involved in this end of the process. We think we have some ideas of how things get in, how they might be held for a short period of time. We know that protein synthesis is important if they're going to be around for a long period of time. But we know very, very little about how we get information back out. I'll give another concrete example. Have you ever been walking along, turned a corner, and run into somebody that you recognize, say, from a class? You've only seen them in that class, but you talked to them once or twice, and they told you their name at some point in time. Right now, somebody's standing next to you, and you've stopped, and they're looking expectantly at you like, who is this person that we stopped for? Anyone ever experienced that you can't think of that person's name?
All the time.
All the time. It's a very common human characteristic. Very often, 10 minutes later, when you've walked away, now you can think of that person's name. So obviously the information is inside your head somewhere, or maybe it's out in the cloud somewhere, and it took a while for it to filter from the cloud to your head. But I don't think that our memory uses analogies that are common in computer lingo these days, cloud computing or something. Okay. So presumably it's somewhere in there. We don't know how to access it. That one happens so often, people call it the tip of the tongue phenomenon, as if it's stuck on your tongue. You know, if you could just get it pried loose from your tongue, then you could say their name. You think your memories are stored on your tongue? I think that's the one hypothesis that's probably not right. Don't think your tongue knows people's names. It is what provides the output, though. You have to verbalize it. But it's undoubtedly not where the retrieval mechanism or the storage mechanism is found. Okay? You might have strategies you use. You start trying to think of where you know this person from. When was the last time I saw this person? I can think of 10 other people's names that I know that somehow are in the context of this person. Maybe that will help. Or maybe you can even think, I know this person's name starts with a K. It's probably wrong because it probably actually starts with a C or something instead. Okay, and that might even, in fact, interfere with being able to get the information out. We know a lot about different psychological things that can mess up this aspect of memory. But we don't know what the biological mechanisms are that underlie that. If we really want to understand memory, we need to know about all of these and probably a lot more that we haven't even thought of names for. So in terms of the neuroscience study of memory, we're at the very rudimentary stages at this point in time. I can say that very honestly because that's my field of study. We are ignorant in terms of what we need to know. Next week, I'll show you some of the data that we can actually point to very reliably. But it's literally just scratching the surface. Okay. Unfortunately, when we talk about procedural or operational definitions of terms, people don't agree on them. Okay, was the beginning of class a short time ago now or a long time ago? Medium. Okay. It's longer ago than it was the first time I mentioned it. A lot longer ago than it was when it actually occurred. But I doubt everybody in the class would agree on how we should classify it. Short time ago, long time ago. It's obviously shorter time ago than the beginning of class a week ago. I think we could probably all agree on that. In fact, when we use the term memory, that's probably a misnomer in and of itself. It looks like the brain has multiple memory systems. How many of you, every day that you wake up, have to learn how to walk again? Anybody? No? If you had a really bad car accident, there's a chance that you might have to learn to walk again. But for most people, that's a once-in-a-lifetime experience. However, did anybody here learn to walk in a single session? Okay, you were born, you laid in a crib for 6 months, and then you stood up and were walking? Probably not. Those sorts of things, walking, are things that once we've learned them, we typically don't forget. And I think we could probably agree that they're in some type of long-term store, and in fact, a specific type of long-term store that very often seems to involve the cerebellum as part of the circuitry. Motor skills, things of that sort. A lot of things that we often talk about being within short-term memory or information sort of in the now, psychologists often like to call working memory. Okay, again, what was the first word I said in class today? Okay, now that's in everybody's working memory. You think if I asked you that same question 3 weeks from now and hadn't said I'm going to ask you this question 3 weeks from now, you would remember it? Probably not. It would have been dumped out of your working memory. Perhaps erased, perhaps it just fades away. We don't even know that. Whether it's an active process to get rid of it, or if it just gets pushed aside or decays. We can't necessarily agree on the duration of working memory. I think we could all agree that I've mentioned the word before several times on a scale longer than seconds ago. But by the time you go to two or three more classes today, it's probably going to be gone from your working memory. But right now, it's in working memory. As opposed to knowing your birthday or how to walk or what your name is. Okay. It's information that's useful to you right now. Okay. If I had a pop quiz right now and asked you to write down the first word I said in class today, hopefully everybody would get 100 on it. But if I asked you what was the first word I said when I came in to talk to you about the exam on Tuesday, probably everybody would get a zero on it. That's gone from working memory. Most of you probably paid a lot of attention to it at that moment because it might have had some direct relevance to the exam you were taking. After the exam was over, no real use for it anymore. In fact, it's not of any use to me. I don't even remember what it was. I know I said something before you took the exam, though. So that's in long-term memory. But I don't even know what I said. We know that there are different brain regions that seem to be required for certain types of memory. And we'll look at some of those regions over the next few class meetings. Also, the rest of the chart, I didn't even bother circling. Most of what's in the textbook is completely wrong, and we already knew that before the textbook was even published. So why bother learning something that we already know is wrong? Okay. Let's dwell a little bit more on operational definitions. You're going to hear terminology like this, so it's probably good that you commit some of this to long-term memory. Okay. Most of this terminology came out of psychology. And psychologists like things that are dichotomous, that have sort of extremes, one pole or another pole. And they probably like magnets a lot because they have a north pole and a south pole. Here's one type of operational definition of memory: declarative versus semantic memory. Okay. A declarative memory might be something like if you were presented with five hats, you could point to the hat that belonged to you. Okay. If you don't own a hat, how about five pairs of shoes? They might even all be the same brand of shoes, but different sizes. You could point to them and say, that's my shoe. As opposed to knowing that that's a hat, or that it's a shoe, or what the word my means. We talked about working memory a moment ago. Information about, for instance, things going on in class today. As opposed to reference memory. Okay, you all know that you're at UT Dallas. You know what it means to be a student. You know the definition or difference between being an undergraduate and a graduate student, or between being a student and a professor. So working versus reference memories. It's also dichotomies that people talk about implicit versus procedural memories. An implicit memory for today is knowing where you parked. If you didn't drive, you know, where did you start from today? Where are you right now? What class are you in? If you just nodded off, you know, had your REM sleep rebound for the day. As opposed to procedural memories, like how do you drive a car? How do you park? Perhaps even a procedural memory, how do you get to this specific class? Information that doesn't change nearly as often. Even that's a loose definition because Next semester, you're going to be looking for a different class this time of day. How about autobiographical memory versus exteroceptive memory? Okay. If your life depended on it, you could probably tell me what you did on November the 5th. Depending on your awareness of calendars, you may or may not know that that was the date at which a current event, which is still a hot topic in the news, occurred. One is things that you did that happened to you. One is other things that are just sort of bigger picture, factual information. Okay, it'd be like the difference between if it was a question on the next exam, most of you could probably get 100% on when is your birthday. Okay, but if another question was when was Einstein's birthday, there'd probably be one or two people in the class that would know that for some random reason. Maybe they're obsessed with Einstein, but almost everybody else would fail on that. Not that you don't know what birthdays are or that they're significant dates culturally or whatever, but you probably don't know everybody in the class's birthday, for instance. Maybe you know 10 other people's birthdays. But even then, we would probably consider most of that to be autobiographical, unless it's some historical figure that you learned their birthday for some reason. The rest of them are somebody like your mother or your girlfriend or something of that sort. Reality is, it looks like trying to divide things up into two categories is probably a false dichotomy. Some of these things fall more on a continuum. Okay, if you had to do a report on Einstein and wrote down his birthday and then use that in another report the next year in school, and over again, the fact that you now know Einstein's birthday is sort of autobiographical information now, rather than an external information. It has some relevance to things that went on in your life. Reference memory, the fact that you know you're a UTD student. Well, at one point in time, that was working information. And in fact, presumably, most of you are not going to be UTD students forever. Then you'll be a UTD alumni, or you dropped out from UTD, or something of the sort. And then there will be other reference information. Okay. The fact that you know how to walk right now, if we cut off one of your legs, Chris, you want to come up and be the guinea pig for that? You pass on that one? Okay. Damn. I had my knife already too. Okay. And then later you learn to walk with a prosthetic device. Okay, now you probably have a different procedural memory of walking. If somehow we could then miraculously restore your leg, you might be able to recall that earlier procedural memory. We don't know. We can't do that experiment right now. So all of these are working definitions. They're soft definitions, in other words. They're not precise things that we can always point to reliably. And that makes it very hard when we're trying to study the biology of them, when we can't even define the sort of thing that people can measure very readily. How many of you have ever said after you took an exam, I could have done better on that exam? I knew more than that. Okay. That's an operational definition of your memory, the grade you got on that exam. It's probably not 100% accurate. Sometimes you might have gotten lucky, gotten a better grade than you should have. Should we count that against you? We'd never know if that happened. So unfortunately, we have to use these operational definitions all the time, even though we know they have limitations. And they don't necessarily reflect reality. Have we seen where the brain lies about things before? Now it's going to lie about lies. That makes it even harder to study the underlying mechanisms. Unfortunately, as well, when we start talking about higher functions in the brain, there's a very large bias to focus on this portion of the brain, the neocortex. There are some good reasons why there is this bias. We are one of the species that has a very large neocortex. In fact, we came up with a name for it. We called it neocortex. New cortex. Must have been an advertising executive that came up with that one. New always means better, right? Okay, if you're living someplace and you move to a new apartment, the new one's always going to be better, right? Not necessarily. Okay, you might be complaining about where you live now, but it could get worse. Or it could get better. Or it could be pretty much equivalent. So new, in advertising, people try to make that synonymous with better, higher, improved. In fact, as far down as we go in mammalian species, they all have neocortex. All the vertebrate species have neocortex. So it's not very new. It's not any newer than paleocortex or archicortex, which both sound older. Because at one point in time, with our level of understanding, people thought those were more primitive systems. In fact, it looks like the nomenclature in some cases should be turned on its head. Higher functions are often carried out by some of those other ones that have less glamorous names. Everybody remember how many layers neocortex had? Six-layered cortex. Anybody remember how many layers archicortex has? We talked about that yet? How many layers? You mentioned it twice, but I don't know if anybody remembered. Anybody know a region of the brain that is archicortex? We talked about one a lot for this last exam that started with hippo. Any part of the brain that starts with hippo? Hippocampus, and that's archicortex. Anybody know how many layers it has?
Four or five.
Four or five? It's a good guess. It's wrong, but it's not six. If I tell you it's a higher order cortex than neocortex, does that help? Higher order must mean more layers, right? So maybe 10 layers? Does that sound reasonable? No? Chris guessed a smaller number. It has three. It's one area of archicortex. Some other areas of archicortex have three. Some have none. You can't even differentiate layers. Some have two. But almost all of them have fewer layers than neocortex. It has six. In neocortex, what was the basic input layer? Layer six? Layer one? Layer four. Okay, but there are violations to that rule. Some of the inputs come in layers two and three as well. And some of the cortical inputs come in layer one. What was the output layer from neocortex? Clear five. Okay. And it had these columns of organization in neocortex. You think all of cortex has columns? That's just a characteristic of neocortex, pretty much. Okay. Another reason that there's a bias towards neocortex. Out there we have all these areas that we call primary sensory areas. Everybody remember V1? What was that primary for? Vision, sight. How about A1? Auditory cortex, primary auditory. Okay, how about S1? Somatosensory cortex. Okay, how about T1? Did we talk about a T1? For taste? Now there's maybe a little chunk in somatosensory. Where else was there some primary taste cortex? Insula. And how about primary olfactory cortex? Was it called O1? There were two of them there. In fact, we'll look at one of them again today. One of the big things that people point to when they say that neocortex is very important for higher order function is that as you go up the scale of phylogeny from more primitive organisms to more advanced organisms, and obviously we know humans are the most advanced, right? There is more and more of the regions that are not primary sensory or primary motor cortices. More of what we call the association areas. The areas that are not one or the other, that interconnect between them and have perhaps other functions. But just again as a reminder, there are other species, like various cetaceans, that have much larger brains than ours, by body mass as well as by total brain size, and also have more association cortex. So are you smarter than a dolphin? Who's to say what we mean by smart? I don't think a dolphin's going to come in and pass the next neuroscience exam. So by that operational definition, you're smarter than a dolphin. If you're a neuroscience major, that's a measure of your higher cognitive function. And again, the dolphin is at the beach every day. Anybody here have that luxury? So maybe the dolphin's smarter than you. Hard to say. This is something that smartness or intelligence is another one of those operationally defined terms. Higher or lower, in this case, is an operationally defined term. We probably wouldn't have trouble saying that, in most cases, a dolphin is smarter than a rat. Perhaps a human is smarter than a rat. Although those of you that work with rats on a daily basis might know of some examples where that was not true. A rat could easily outsmart a human. Keep convincing the human to put their finger in front of their face so they could bite them again. Force the human to feed them every day. The rats aren't probably going to feed you every day. So these are operationally defined terms. In fact, when we talk about different regions within cortex, we usually use very outmoded definitions of what we mean by different regions. We depend on the kind of stuff that Brodmann came up with, and we saw those awful Mac Paint type drawings earlier in the semester, where with fairly simple stains and a fairly non-sophisticated microscope, you could tell clear differences, say, between this region of cortex and this region. The width of the different layers were different. The number of neurons within a specific layer were different. Maybe even the number of glial cells in the different regions were different. They were physically located in different regions of the brain.
But these days, we have much more sophisticated techniques so that we can typically, for any of these divisions that Brodmann came up with, in many cases, we can divide them into dozens of other subregions. In terms of functional differences, in terms of the proteins they express, in terms of the different receptors for different transmitters, in terms of the different transmitters they use to communicate within columns, in terms of the level of glucose utilization, in terms of the number of subunits of a specific type that make up a specific type of receptor. We can continue to divide it up into finer and finer and finer and finer gradations to where eventually, if we really want to get precise, we would do it neuron by neuron. And as I mentioned earlier today, not just neuron by neuron, but glial cell by glial cell as well. There's a heck of a lot more glial cells than neurons. If we get to that level, don't take a neuroscience anatomy class in the future. You'll have to memorize, 100 billion different names for different regions. Those of you that find it hard right now, memorizing a couple hundred billion might be even harder. So for most purposes, we're going to stick with these outmoded definitions, but recognize that they have a lot of limitation to them. When we start talking about problems with memory or any type of behavioral output problems, and memory is just one thing that we measure by behavioral output, people often like to say, well, we know where this is localized. Well, here's an example of a problem that somebody can have. We give two different people a task. We say, draw a picture of a clock. Make it as accurate as you can. One person produces a drawing that looks like this. It looks a lot like that clock over there. Okay, if we weren't specific enough in the instructions, they might have drawn a square with some digits on it. But we would probably recognize it as a clock. Another person given the same instructions, this is what they produce. They have what we call contralateral neglect. It's as if they can't see part of what they're doing or can't produce part of what they're doing. And it's sometimes hard to tell which is the difference. Okay, we give them another test. Say, draw a house. Well, this is probably somebody in about third grade drawing a house. Maybe you could add a little more three dimension to the picture. But this is a person given the same instructions that has contralateral neglect. Okay. Very often, diagnostically, people will say this is an indication of a specific brain lesion. Unfortunately, these are the brain lesions that have been widely reported in the literature that produce these types of deficits. Damage to wide areas of neocortex, more circumscribed areas of neocortex. This is basically in what? The what or where pathway of vision. Where pathway. Okay. This looks more like could be higher order auditory cortex. It's hard to say what specific part of temporal lobe. Again, a very wide area. One closer up to the motor strip here. One again more restricted and even more restricted in temporal cortex. All of them producing very similar outcomes, behavioral deficits. Anyone ever heard the name Carl Lashley? Okay, Lashley? Well, you're hearing it now. It's one you should probably remember. Anybody remember a speaker we had 2 weeks ago by the name of James McGaw? Came and gave a talk on a Friday morning about memory. And I believe he's in D.C. this week receiving the Lashley Award, which he thought was notable because Lashley was a hero of his when he was a student. And now after he's been a neuroscientist for 50 years, he's getting the Lashley Award. The Lashley Award is sort of ironic. actually spent his whole career studying people with brain damage like this, and in fact, making brain damage in animals, trying to localize where memories are stored. He eventually came to the conclusion, didn't matter where in the brain you damaged. If you damaged enough, you wiped out the memory. If you damaged a small enough area, no matter where it was, with a couple of exceptions, memories were fine. A couple of exceptions were the hippocampus and the amygdala. If you damaged them, memories you'd already made were fine, but you couldn't make new memories. So he concluded memories weren't stored in any one specific place. We've come a little bit beyond Lashley's interpretation since then to say that memories are distributed. They probably are actually stored in specific places, but not one specific place. Certain aspects of the memory might be in one region of the brain, other aspects in another region of the brain, probably never in a single neuron in any one of those regions. And it's putting that whole pattern back together that makes the memory. Sometimes the memory is complete and has all the aspects. Sometimes it's only partial. And sometimes that partial memory can then draw in some of that other information. But if nothing else, Lashley told us that probably doing lesion studies is not the approach to use to try to figure out memory in the nervous system. And it only took him 50 years to find that out. So McGaugh thought it was good that he was getting it because he did not use Lashley's techniques. And yet he has been successfully studying memory for 50 years after Lashley's time. So we still rely on old definitions of regions in the nervous system. These are some of the areas that people widely study, adding cortex, when they talk about memory. One is the prefrontal cortex, the region in front of the motor area in the frontal lobes. For most purposes, we divide that into three different regions. Okay, it's bounded by what is called the arcuate sulcus. The arcuate lies between the prefrontal cortex and the supplementary motor and premotor and motor cortex. So it's the area that divides the motor regions from the other regions in the frontal lobes. And then there's another dividing line in the prefrontal cortex that's called the principal sulcus. This is a monkey brain, but it's very similar in the human brain. And it runs basically parallel to your feet. Divides a dorsal portion from a ventral portion. It would be simple if anatomists stuck to simple names, but they don't. They call the dorsal portion of prefrontal cortex the superior part. Except some people insist on calling it the dorsal part. But the most common name is the superior part of prefrontal cortex. Doesn't mean it's any better, just means it's above the rest. And typically above the principal sulcus. They also talk, modern terminology, they use the term lateral prefrontal cortex, towards the sides. And if you look at it from below, you see that there's lateral on each side, and in fact it wraps around from the side and part of the bottom of prefrontal cortex as well. Remember, even though this looks nice and big and imposing, cortex is only about that thick. Maybe a couple, 3 millimeters thick in your brain. In most places, not that thick at all. And there's one more part that they talk about that you can't see on the outer surface. You have to pull the brain out of the skull and look at the portion that's above the eyeballs. the orbitofrontal portion, orbital frontal cortex. Sometimes you'll hear that referred to as medial prefrontal cortex, because it's in the middle. How many of you have had neuroanatomy? You heard all these divisions before, right? Hopefully. Okay. Cingulate cortex. This is the cortex that lies along between the two hemispheres. This one people typically divide into two regions, although recent literature has started chopping it up in more. But most of what you read will talk about the anterior cingulate cortex, the part in the front, okay, right behind the prefrontal cortex, which is here, the anterior cingulate cortex, and the part that's further back, the posterior cingulate cortex. It looks like these have different functions from one another. Some authors will talk about the middle, or medial wouldn't be a good name, the intermediate cingulate cortex, the sort of border between the two. Or they'll talk about specialized functions of the part that's right here, sort of wraps around the corpus callosum. But for our purposes, anterior and posterior is more than enough to know. And we also have the parahippocampal cortex, or the parahippocampal region. But again, you can't see from the outside of the brain. You have to pop the brain out of the skull to see it. Chris, you want to volunteer?
I'll
have a good day. If I give you a day post-mortem, we can look at yours? I don't think so. You're going to have to earn the A. Something more than just donating your brain. Worth a try. Parahippocampal cortex lies in front of some of these visual areas. This is basically V5 right here. In front, in fact, of a region I'll look at in a little more detail in a minute, what we call occipital temporal cortex. From that name, which lobe of the brain is it in? The occipital lobe or the temporal lobe? Sort of on the border of both. Occipital temporal cortex. Right in front of that is the region, very medial, that we call parahippocampal cortex. And it's right behind this one I mentioned earlier, one of the two primary olfactory cortices. The entorhinal cortex. Is entorhinal just for olfaction? No, it turns out that's the primary area of cortex that sends inputs into the hippocampus. It's also the primary area of cortex that gets outputs from the hippocampus. The next largest number of outputs from the hippocampus goes to the portions up here above the eyes, all those different prefrontal areas. And the next largest number of outputs out of the hippocampus, to this region, parahippocampal. Everybody heard of these in anatomy? Good. Medial temporal lobe. Medial, and this is the temporal cortex here. In humans, some of auditory cortex is right in here. Okay. That region that we looked at just a moment ago, the occipital temporal cortex, this part right here, right behind the parahippocampal, is a region, at least in primates, which is where it's been mainly studied, seems to be specialized for face recognition. One of our faculty members in the cognitive side, Dr. O'Toole, could tell you a whole 2 semesters worth about this region of cortex. She brings speakers in regularly to talk about it. So if you're interested, go to one of those talks. This is among the sorts of things that people have noted in that region. If you record for neurons in occipital temporal cortex and show a picture or an actual example of a face of the particular species you're recording from, the neurons in that region respond very strongly to that stimulus. You show them a scrambled version of a face from their same species, you still get a response out of those neurons. Not as strong. They know that's not a normal face, but they know it has the characteristics that make up a face. In fact, you can obscure part of it, like put a hat on, put a mask on, put sunglasses on, whatever, just put an opaque strip across it, they still know it's a face. In fact, it looks about as much like a face as the intact face did. Show them a different species face. A couple of examples here. They still recognize it's a face. Could have been a female face instead of a male. They would have still responded as a face. Show them another body part, though. They know that's not a face. The neurons differentiate that. Why would we have a big chunk of the cortex that's devoted just to recognizing faces? Is it important for you, for instance, to know the difference between different people? Okay. Would you use exactly the same language if you were talking to your mother as you would talking to someone that you really disliked? I'm not guaranteeing you like your mother. I hope you do. But you'd probably talk differently to your mother. Okay, let's use a better example. Would you use the same language to your roommate that you would to the dean of behavioral and brain sciences? Probably not. How about the president of the university? Think you'd speak the same to them as you would to your roommate? Or your boyfriend or girlfriend? Does it make a difference if you recognize that they are your boyfriend or girlfriend? Probably has very salient biological consequences. But you know the difference between, say, your girlfriend and someone else's girlfriend. If you don't have a functioning occipital temporal cortex for that, okay, maybe there would be some short-term benefits to you. But I would wager that long-term there would be much worse consequences if you couldn't make that distinction. When we're trying to study all these sorts of things, memory, any type of higher cognitive function, as I mentioned, Lashley came up with the idea that maybe lesion methods alone weren't enough. Hopefully, in the modern day of neuroscience, we try to look at multiple levels of analysis when we're looking at higher order function. So not just the behavior, not just a specific region in the brain, but specific networks within different regions, specific cell types, types of communication, whether it's inhibition, excitation, specific kinds of transmitters, difference between neural cells and glial cells, between pyramidal neurons and stellate neurons and other kinds, on down to the level of individual molecules, or at least molecular cascades. And ideally, these different levels of analysis should give us different parts of the picture, but they should also relate to each other in some consistent fashion. And when they're telling us different things, that's usually a clue that we are wrong about something. Or we don't know enough. We need to do more work in that area. Okay. I think I'll stop at this point. We'll talk about some behavioral tests and some of the neurobiological underpinnings next week.